hello and welcome to M. Night Frights, the Talk Film Society podcast celebrating the genre films of Manoj Neliyattu Shyamalan, a.k.a. M. Night Shyamalan. I'm your host, Manish Mathur, staff writer at Talk Film Society. This episode, I'm talking about Shyamalan's 2008 environmental horror film, The Happening, starring Mark Wahlberg, Zooey Deschanel, John Leguizamo, Ashlyn Sanchez, and Betty Buckley. I'm joined today by a very special guest, the editor-in-chief at Talk Film Society, Marcelo Pico. How are you?
I'm doing well, Manish. Thank you for having me on this podcast. I'm a fan.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Actually, when I pitched this series to you at one of our meetings, you asked for The Happening, and I'm just curious, like, had you seen it before, or what's your history with the film?
With the film itself, I was trying to think about that as I rewatched it this morning. I didn't see it in theaters. I think at this point, I had, like, started to veer away from M. Night Shyamalan. And this was 10 years ago. So, I mean, I was a fan of The Sixth Sense. I was a fan of Unbreakable. I was a fan of Signs. You know, but then Lady in the Water happened, which I have not seen. But I just heard bad things. And then The Happening came out. I heard bad things. And I didn't end up seeing it in theaters. Because back then, more so than now, I guess I listened to people online and critics and Rotten Tomatoes, and I was like, oh, people say it's a bad movie? I'll skip it then.
Yeah.
So I skipped it in theaters, but I saw it on, I think it was Netflix DVD, back when they used to mail DVDs in the mail. And I was like, oh, this, it's interesting. I said, it's an interesting movie. Is some of it, I would say, is, you could categorize it as bad, you know, but it's interesting. And then it wasn't until this morning I saw it again, and I'm like, oh, okay, I like this movie. I can definitely say that now, you know, 10 years later. It's, to me, a lot of it is legitimately terrifying. I like the environmental message that it has. It's certainly silly. It veers towards being campy. Either that or it's bad. I don't know. It's a very interesting movie for me, and I think it's overall good, and I like that. I appreciate it now that I'm back to being a big M. Night Shyamalan fan after, you know, Split. I'm glad I'm here to talk about it because, if any of his movies need defending, I think it's this one.
There's definitely a lot to talk about the film, and a lot of the things you mentioned are definitely things I want to touch on. Before we get to that, I do want to tell listeners that this is a spoiler podcast, so we will get into the full details of the plot and the film's ending. So if you have not seen The Happening and you are curious, you know, press pause, watch the film, and then come back. But yeah, I mean, for me, I remember the ad campaign back in 2008. I remember a lot of the hype was that it was M. Night's first R-rated movie after working in PG-13 for his entire career, or at least from... Actually, now I can't remember if Lady in the Water was PG or PG-13, but he definitely was working on that level. And I think that with The Happening, a lot of the buzz around the film was, you know, it's M. Night doing R-rating. It's going to be violent, it's going to be gory, and I read some interviews today with him from, like, MTV and People Magazine, and the way that he was promoting the film was, he used the word traumatizing a few times, and a lot of that could just be, you know, marketing spin, you know, he's trying to get people to go see the film, but I think on some level, that phrasing and, like, the way he talked about the film and the ad campaign and, you know, the poster has, like, this ridiculous tagline. I don't know if you saw it or read it, but it's, like, first we sensed it, then we saw the signs, now it's happening.
Yeah.
It's so classic M. Night that it's horrible but also wonderful because only he could get away with it. I mean, he didn't get away with it, actually. This film was, like, the death knell for his career at the time. You know, I hadn't seen it when it came out, but I watched it, I believe, like, last year. There were definitely a lot of things that I enjoyed about the film, but a lot of the things that I didn't like were very glaring, and hard to swallow.
Yeah.
You know, for me, like, the opening 2 or 3 minutes of the film, including these, like, credits that have, for some reason, the credits are set to, like, a bright blue sky and, like, beautiful clouds, and this really ominous James Newton Howard score. So the image is a little incongruous, I think, but it definitely, the score at least sets up the tone. But then you have the scene in the park where you just have these two women sitting, and one starts mumbling to herself, and she just takes, like, a pin from her hair, or, like, one of those, like, hair chopsticks, I guess, and slashes her throat, and it's very... It's really creepy. It's a really striking, horrifying start to the film. And the next scene at the construction zone, where we're seeing more mass suicides, he does utilize the R rating. It's not so much that it's, like, bloody, but just very, like, gruesome. And it's, like, graphic without being too gory.
Yeah, and going back to that R rating thing, right before I started the movie, I'm like, oh, wait, is this rated R? Because I had completely forgotten about that campaign. And I guess I wasn't fully into movies as I was before, around this time, because this came out, like, what, June 2008?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I was a little busy being in the Air Force, so I kind of missed a lot of movies that played during this time. But I guess I just missed that whole campaign. It's M. Night's first R-rated movie. And I just forgot about that fact until this morning. I looked it up and go, oh, it is R-rated. And yeah, man, I forgot about that first scene in the park. And that first face you see is Kristen Connolly, who I love. Like, she's a
great... Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and I'm like, oh, like, she's in this. And I thought during this rewatch she would play a bigger role than what she does. She's only in it for, like, 2 minutes. But it's interesting to see her in this movie in this limited role. Like, but no, it's super chilling, these opening shots, especially the shot of, like, those construction workers jumping off the roof, and the shot of the construction worker looking up and seeing this horror. It's terrifying.
It's really something that M. Night does really well in his films. He can set up sort of his more horrific elements pretty well with just really, like, arresting images. You know, for me, the film really falls apart almost immediately after those first two scenes, where you have Mark Wahlberg playing. Actually, it's funny. I thought he was playing an actual scientist, and for some reason, completely forgot about the scene in this classroom with his students. Yeah. But he's a science teacher, which doesn't make much sense.
No. So let's talk about Mark Wahlberg in this.
Yeah.
I do not understand, like, his role in this movie makes me reconsider any movie he's ever been in, and I'm like, is he even a good actor? Because he's not good in this. I can say that for sure. He is miscast. It's like he doesn't understand what's happening in the happening, like, in terms of, like, what the tone is going for, and that may be M. Night Shyamalan's fault too. He is the one part that I'm like, if they might have recast with somebody else, may have worked better. But yeah, his line delivery in a lot of this, especially this opening scene with him talking to his students, it's super weird. I do not like Mark Wahlberg in this movie. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, so this is, you know, 2008. It's shortly after his Oscar-nominated performance in The Departed.
That's right.
Yeah, and so he's kind of on the rise, but definitely, I mean, he had been working for, you know, over 10 years. I mean, Boogie Nights is in 1997, but, or 98. It's definitely, so he's been around, but this is, like, the beginning of Mark Wahlberg, like, as a major movie star. So M. Night claims in his interviews and on, like, the IMDb page that he wrote this film with Mark Wahlberg in mind. I do not believe that
for a second.
There's no way. This is definitely a studio hire, in my opinion. And I was wondering what actor would actually make this film better. And I came up with Paul Rudd, perhaps.
Paul Rudd, yeah.
I think he's a versatile actor anyway, that he could pull off any role. But, you know, Mark Wahlberg has such a specific persona that, especially now in this sort of pain and gain Transformers part of his career, he doesn't work in the film. He has no chemistry with any of the other actors, especially Zooey Deschanel playing his wife. And that's I definitely have a lot of thoughts on that marriage, this plot.
Well, I like Zoe Deschanel in this. She's not especially great in it. She is a little off too, but not as off as Mark Wahlberg in terms of line delivery and performance. But I like her.
You can see Zooey Deschanel in a better version of this film, and it makes sense somewhat. You know, she can play a conflicted wife and conflicted person, and I don't know if she's done horror after. I can't quite remember in her career, but I don't think so. I think she could fit in pretty well. I mean, she was known for indie comedies at the time, and this is the year before 500 Days of Summer. This is definitely a departure for her in terms of her career. And I think, yeah, a better version of this film, I think she could have been really good in. I think Mark Wahlberg said that Amy Adams was in consideration.
Okay, that would have been better.
He's actually, he said something that, like, along the lines of Amy Adams dodged a bullet by not being in Happening, and I think Amy Adams' career is untouchable. Like, I don't think she can do anything that would make her career, like, sink.
No. I mean, and you know, nobody's career went to crap after this anyway, right?
Well, except for M. Night.
Except for M. Night. I mean, well, M. Night eventually recovered. But, I mean, I guess in terms of actors, I mean, you have some solid actors and character actors in this. I like John Leguizamo in this, you know? He might actually be the one actor who I don't mind that much. I've always liked him as a character actor. And in here, like, yeah, I bought his, like, he plays a worried dad, worried for his daughter and his wife. So, and I think he pulls it off.
Yeah, but I feel like he has none of the actors have any chemistry, and the dialogue is so clunky and forced. It's just a bad cocktail.
It is. You know, you got a point, because I don't buy Leguizamo and Mark Wahlberg as friends. I don't buy them as friends. The whole interaction. Well, I guess we can get into that relationship thing between Mark Wahlberg and Zooey Deschanel. Upon rewatch, I don't mind as much as, like, when I first saw it. Not to get too into details, but I understood what they were going through, you know, after going through my life so far. And I see what you know, M. Night was going for in terms of, like, writing this, you know, plot about this marriage falling apart because one person is not fully into it and possibly, you know, cheating or thinking about cheating.
Or eating dessert.
Just eating dessert. I understood what was going on. I liked it for the most part. You know, but then, like you say, the chemistry itself, the fact that, Wahlberg and Deschanel don't have, you know, don't click together. The fact that Leguizamo is like a friend of Mark Wahlberg and trying to look out for him and hates Deschanel and, you know, and it all doesn't really add up.
It's funny you say that you didn't mind the marriage subplot in this time around, because when I watched it, that really stuck out to me. And I was just like, I think because I've been watching M. Night's films in a close amount of time together. And so I've been noticing, you know, these recurring themes of, like, family, relationships, things like that, and kind of rebuilding the family unit. And I felt like a total misfire. I mean, he did it so well in The Sixth Sense and Signs and even The Village, but in this film, it just felt like just watching people who had never met before. And I don't even think these actors had met each other before they started shooting. I mean, they all come from such different corners of the industry. But, like, the scene in the train station, it was just like watching three people who were speaking five different conversations at once. And
That's the scene I was thinking about when you said there's no chemistry between any of them. Yeah, it's just so bizarre, that train station scene. When they meet up and Leguizamo gives them, you know, the tickets. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
But no, I guess on paper, I like what he was attempting to do with that romance.
Sure, I agree with that.
But, you know, in between all this, like, I am a fan of, like, what's actually driving all these characters, you know. Even though I'm not a fan of the actors, for the most part, playing their roles, I like what they're actually going through and, like, the thrills that M. Night Shyamalan, you know, pulls in this whole opening of the movie.
A lot of the scare scenes I thought really worked well for me this time. The scenes like where they're driving and they come across the electricians who are just like hung themselves from the power lines. Oh, yeah. Like that was really scary. I can sort of see the tension that M. Night is creating, the sense of paranoia of like running. And he mentioned the birds and Invasion of the Body Snatchers as two reference points.
Yeah.
And I think it's a stretch to say that he like achieved that level. But I can see the traces of that in there.
One movie that I think about when I think about this, and I've always wanted to ask M. Night Shyamalan or have him confirm this, I always think of Maximum Overdrive, the Stephen King movie, which is kind of sort of similar in plot. There's a outside force, you know, killing people, and there are these survivors that try to, I guess, survive, you know, the outer forces that are trying to kill them. And it has like the same level to me as like, I guess, mean-spiritedness. The fact that there are so many gruesome kills in both movies, and the fact that, you know, they're both considered "quote unquote" bad movies to some people, but I see a lot to be appreciated in both. So that's what I compare it to. I don't know if that was an influence. Probably not. Has M. Night Shyamalan seen Maximum Overdrive? I don't know, Manish.
yeah, I don't know. But you know who liked The Happening as well? Stephen King.
Oh, he did like it. Okay, good.
Yeah, I read that online today, and I was like, yeah, I mean, there are definitely parallels there. I really appreciated the scene with the mom who is on the phone with her daughter.
Yeah.
I think in Princeton. And yeah. It's kind of shot in like the middle of this crowd, and like the camera is behind people and it's kind of going around like the circle. And this poor woman's on the phone with her daughter trying to get more information. And she puts the daughter on speakerphone, and we can like hear her succumbing to the toxin and committing suicide. And it's such an effective performance. I actually looked up who that actress was, and her name is Carrie O'Malley. She's kind of an actress who appears in a lot of supporting side roles. And I really thought she was great. And I really liked the way that Shyamalan filmed that scene, because it would have been so easy for him to like cut to Princeton and show it, but just having it on the phone to be, because like the mind's eye is more, it can scare you more than what you're actually seeing. And I really like when M. Night does that. He does it quite often. In fact, I was thinking that he doesn't really need the R rating, because he so effectively does scares through suggestion. That showing it as he does, in showing it even more than he does, would kind of rob him of that skill.
Yeah, one of the most effective kills in this is when the cop shoots himself, and it's entirely off screen. You see him fall down. It's a one take. The camera, you know, pans over, and you see somebody else pick it up, and they shoot themselves off screen. Then they fall, and then the camera pans over, and somebody else picks it up. And I love that shot. And there's really no violence in it, except, you know, some blood splattering from the head when they fall down. But that's it. Like, yeah, you're right. He doesn't need the R rating. But you get moments where somebody gets run over by a lawnmower, and that's super effective too. So,
and the scene with the video from the zoo is also pretty graphic.
Thank you for reminding me about that, because as soon as I saw that, I go, oh, like it's just like Signs, like that.
Yeah, I was just thinking it's a callback to Signs, right? Yeah.
And it has to be like a direct callback, because that's the first thing I thought of. As I was watching this, I thought about post 9/11 movies and how this fits well into that genre. It terrified me even more watching it now, more than it did when I first saw it, I guess because I didn't make the connection. And also, like, fairly recently this year, I've been watching movies from 2008 and around the time when filmmakers were directly addressing it in their own ways, like Cloverfield and War of the Worlds, Spielberg's War of the Worlds. And this falls in line with that. It's super terrifying to see these people running from, and they say it, like they think it's a terrorist attack. And that moment, like when the mother's talking to her daughter on the phone, like that has to be like a parallel to, like, you know, people you know, on 9/11 in the tower calling their family members or people on the planet too. So that especially just really shook me this time thinking about that. So he plays this well. These horrors we know so well in this story about plants trying to kill people.
That's really the problem here with The Happening, is that you have this great setup. You have these individual scenes that are so effectively done, and the reveal doesn't, it's not satisfying. It's at least not to me.
I've accepted it over the years, I guess, is when I think somebody spoiled it to me before I saw it. I go, plants? That's it? Really? That's the twist? And yeah, Mark Wahlberg talking to a plastic plant, that's super ridiculous. But I don't know, I think it works for me, especially in 2018 when, you know, a few weeks ago we got the news that the world is going to end because climate change will kill us all in, like, you know, a few decades.
Right.
So that's especially scary. I don't say I'm not going to say I like the reveal. I accept it. You know, it's super silly, but I buy it.
I like the idea of this film having an environmentalist message, and I'm sure it's something that was on M. Night's mind when he was doing it. And, you know, as you said, it is pretty relevant, but I think the problem that I have with this film in particular is that he seems to be chasing the idea that this is all just something that's not in our control. Like, his idea is that the environment is killing these people, but it's just like some other force that we can't predict or stop, rather than being like, for example, in the opening scene with Mark Wahlberg, I mean, he says that, like, that one student says, oh, it's something that's beyond our control or some force of nature that can't be stopped. And Mark Wahlberg says, yeah, that's right. But that's such an anti-science message. And it's I won't say it's anti-science, but it's definitely antithetical to what, like, scientists actually believe. And I was reading up about, you know, scientists' reaction to this, and some of them appreciated that he had a pro-environmentalist message in the film, but I think some people were also a little confused how a science teacher at a high school would agree that bees disappearing from the world is some force of nature that can't actually be stopped. And, you know, I mean, M. Night does run up against, you know, Christian, Catholic, Episcopalian teachings or ideas in his films. I mean, he went to Catholic school, I believe. I can appreciate that he has these ideas about God or whatever, or some force in the world, but I think almost by accident he made this film seem less interested in actual science than some kind of greater force.
No, yeah. So, yeah, you do make a great point now that I think about it. Like, yeah, it doesn't tie up as well science-wise as I think it should. And the rules of the game kind of don't make sense to me, you know, especially when I watched it this morning. I'm like, so if you're in a group of people running through a field, you get killed. But if you're, like, in a group of four, you're fine. And then by the end, it doesn't matter. Like, and then it just stops.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was interesting because, you know, these rules that he's coming up with are rules that the humans are saying to each other, so maybe they don't understand it as well. But I think that's also a cop-out answer. I mean, I think he was just inconsistent.
Yes, yeah, I can see that inconsistency. But yeah, I guess I like the fact that nature is trying to kill us. I think that's the main theme that I enjoy. It's not religious, it's just like the unexplained. The unexplained in there. And yeah, when we talk about climate change and
I also don't see him saying that it's humans that ultimately, like, I mean, because climate is all about how we treat the environment and how we can stop and help, you know, help the environment. But I don't see him taking that step either. It just seems like just some natural thing. To me, the environmentalist message felt half-hearted.
Yeah, I understand that. I don't know. I mean, it's now I'm trying to think about the movie and, like, its overall message. It's, you know, I like the fact that this is 90 minutes long.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because it's just in and out. It always seems so long to me when they reach the old lady in the house. In my mind, I always think that's like a 30-minute sequence when it's only like 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
and I'm glad it is so short. It's in and out with it. And the scenes towards the end, especially that long scene 3 months later, guy on a TV talking about, you know, what just happened and plants and all this, and how do we know they're not going to do it again? And then cut to, is it France or somewhere?
Yeah, I believe they're in Paris.
Yeah, in Paris. But yeah, but that felt especially long. I'm like, okay, I get it. I get the message. I don't need a guy explaining it to me again.
That also felt like half the birds, half Psycho.
Yeah, that's
right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Psycho has the infamous, you know, psychiatrist speech at the end, and then the birds also ends with a question mark. And so it's kind of like, okay, M. Night, we got it. You like Hitchcock.
What? Is that a reveal? He likes Hitchcock? What?
That's the twist in the happening.
That's the twist.
You know, you mentioned the 90-minute thing, and I think that's very intentional. This movie doesn't seem like the kind of movie that was cut down by a studio. I mean, M. Night has Final Cut on all his films, but he, in the interview that I read this morning, he said that The Happening, he was intending it to be an excellent B-movie, or like the best B-movie of all time. And again, half of that could just be, you know, dumb marketing stuff he came up with. But I think he's trying to do something that's like campy and silly and kind of goofy. The budget of the film is $48 million, which is low for M. Night, but high for this kind of movie.
Yeah.
And this movie has a very self-serious tone. So when it does indulge in like this like silly kind of B movie horror stuff, like them running in the fields from the wind, or the Betty Buckley scenes towards the end, it rings false in a way that it wouldn't. It had it been more winking and more goofy throughout the whole thing. I mean, for me, M. Night doing a B movie is like The Visit, or even Split, because like those movies have a very tongue-in-cheek, wry tone to it, even as they're delivering a strong emotional story and delivering the scares.
I agree with that. Like, it's the tone here, you know, that I'm confused by at times. He was trying here to be tongue-in-cheek, to be campy. I don't think it fully succeeds. It's just in those moments when, I mean, okay, let's, and this section is going to be the part where I'm throwing my hands up and saying, I don't know what you're doing, and my Shyamalan. When they get to the house with the old lady, okay, this has always been the part where I'm like, what is going on? Because, okay, because right before that, and I want to highlight this kill, and this is like important because, again, tone. When they're split off with the two kids, right? The field, the wind is trying to kill them, and now they're in a group of like five, you know, three of them and then two kids. They knock on this door, and these two kids are being assholes, you know, trying to break down the door, and then they get shot brutally with a shotgun.
Yeah.
It is insane. It always blows me away that it's a gruesome death. This kid, I don't know how old he is, like what, 12, 13, I don't know.
Yeah,
he gets blown away, and we see it. we see the shotgun shells like streaming through him, and then the other kid gets shot in the head. You don't see that, but you know, you see like his head wound later. It's super gruesome. I'm like, whoa, okay. That's a serious tone. These two kids getting blown away. And then the next, you know, scene is them reaching the house with the old lady. And this is bizarre to me. I do not know what's happening. I realize I've said happening a lot in this episode where we're talking about The Happening. But no.
It's hard not to. Film a lot too. And yeah.
But yeah, again, it's tone. He's trying to be tongue-in-cheek, but they don't appreciate or they don't understand the kind of movie they're in at this point, especially Mark Wahlberg. But I will say Betty Buckley kind of understands. I like her as the old woman, but yeah, this sequence is just weird. I don't understand.
Yeah, it's really – I mean, I don't even know what he's trying to say or do.
Exactly. I don't know what he's trying to say.
She's great. I mean, I agree with you. It's a really fun performance, and I'm glad that she worked with M. Night again in Split. You know, she's great in that film as well. But yeah, it's so weird, not in keeping with the tone. You're right. Like, I didn't even make that connection. Like, the scene right before that is those two boys getting killed. And they're not even being killed by the toxin. They're being killed by, like, other humans.
Yeah. which I understand, you know, it's M. Night Shyamalan saying, hey, humans are terrible people. Don't forget that. It's not only nature, it's humans. And we're doing this to ourselves, too. But it's, yeah, again, tone. You know, saying that, and then right after that, saying, hey, this old woman's crazy. She has a doll in her bed for whatever reason. And she slaps the little girl's hand trying to get another cookie. And
yeah,
she accuses Mark Wahlberg of planning to smother her in her sleep.
Which I thought was kind of a funny line. I remember watching it, like, jolting up, being like, wait, she just said that?
But it's funny to me. I can't even explain it.
Yeah.
It's funny to me, but I don't think it's funny in the way that M. Night Shyamalan is telling me it's funny. Right? Does that make sense?
That's the best way to put it. Actually.
Yeah, because Mark Wahlberg's line delivery again. It's bad. she says, hope you're not going to smother me in my sleep. And he goes, no, I'm not. Oh, it's crazy. So yeah, when I saw this, like, maybe for the second time a few years ago, I swear I felt that this sequence was like 30 minutes of the movie. It grinded it to a stop, but really it's only like 5-10 minutes, really. Like, she's in it for like maybe a handful of scenes and then she dies. So it's the most confounding thing in the movie for me, and that's, I think, saying a lot, because of all the things that kind of put me off, it's that sequence with Betty Buckley. I'm like, I still don't comprehend what he was going for.
Yeah, I think, you know, this period of M. Night's career is, you know, obviously his lowest period between, you know, with The Village, it was kind of the bloom is off the rose. Like, that was the public perception. Lady in the Water was such an out of left field film for him, being a, you know, bedtime story, fairy tale. And so people thought that him going back to horror would kind of bring his career back. But with the happening, his reputation really just sank. And I feel bad in a sense, because I still don't think that his career is, like, fully recovered. I mean, it has, in that, like, he's making movies that people like, The Visit and Split and Glass coming up. But I still think that his name is still associated as a joke. And I think, you know, with this film, like, he had a really hard time getting it made. He shopped it around to different studios as a spec script. I mean, he had burned the bridge with Touchstone, you know, with Lady in the Water, and even Warner Brothers, who made that film, didn't want to make this one. And he got Fox to fund it, 20th Century Fox, but he also had to get an Indian company, UTV, to co-finance it for about half of it. Yeah, it was kind of a tough job for him to do, and the film had to go through several rewrites, but still he couldn't make it work. I mean, a lot of M. Night's worst instincts as a writer really come through in this film. Like, I mean, it just goes back to, like, this human storyline. It just doesn't work, and the whole film just falls apart, no matter how well directed, like, the suspense scenes are.
And I'll say, because of how well those, you know, suspense scenes are filmed, it's not a low point for me for him. To me, at this point, he is seemingly still trying to be, you know, the auteur M. Night Shyamalan. But then with the next two movies, he just, to me personally, he just loses it. He just gets lost in the big budget special effects in that machine.
The Happening is definitely an interesting failure. Like, it's, you can see what he's going for. We've been talking about this film for a lot longer than I thought we would be.
I apologize.
No, it's fine. I'm glad. The Happening opened in June of 2008. It opened at number 3 at $30 million, which is about 30 to 40 million is usually where M. Night's films go. This is on the lower end, but the film was quickly flopping the next week. I think it had a really bad word of mouth. So it only made about 65 million domestically. But it did make about $99 million overseas for a total of $163 million. So it did make money. I think a lot of that was just the hype of his first R rating. Yeah, I think once people realized, you know, what the film was actually doing, I think it quickly disappeared from the box office. I did want to bring up that this film was shot by Tak Fujimoto.
Yes, yes. I'm glad you brought that up, yeah.
Yeah, he worked with M. Night twice before in The Sixth Sense and Signs. And I think a lot of the positive things I liked about the film came especially from the camera work. I really liked like the wide shots of the fields but the more like intimate, you know, horrifying close-ups of these people who are, you know, suddenly affected by the toxin. But what did you think of the camera work and cinematography?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up because, yeah, it's one of the things that really heightened it for me this time is appreciating that cinematography. And it reminded me of Fujimoto's work with Jonathan Demme on Silence of the Lambs and Manchurian Candidate. He really knows how to do those close-ups. And there are a lot of them in this movie. Maybe a bit too many. Maybe some were unneeded.
Sure.
The ones that I like the one previously mentioned shot when you see the construction worker looking up and seeing all these, you know, people falling off the roof. That is a terrifying close up, and
yes,
it's beautifully shot, and it captures that horror. And when that happens in the movie, when you see people like terrified in these close ups, it works. So it heightens that. That drama, that tension. So I love the cinematography in this. It's excellent.
M. Night brings back James Newton Howard. This is the sixth one in a row. To me, this score wasn't as memorable as his previous films were, especially, you know, Unbreakable and The Village, which I think are two of the best ones. But I didn't really find this score to be. I thought it handled the film well, but it wasn't too exciting or too original.
The most chilling moments came for me like when it was just like silence, no score.
Right.
Well, the opening theme with Newton's score playing underneath, like that's good. Like I said, like those quieter moments with no score. I think M. Night Shyamalan understood that you don't need that score, or you just need like if you have a score during those moments, it should be not noticeable. You know, it shouldn't be the thing that pushes forward in the film. It should be like the horror on screen, more graphic than anything. The score didn't really stick out to me, but you know, hey, you know, when it did pop up, I did appreciate it.
So, Marcella, do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Seeing it again for this podcast, and being a fan of M. Night Shyamalan again. You know, after his troubled time, The Last Airbender, After Earth, I'm going to say, yeah, I really liked it a lot this time. And I like that now, like, this reminds me of what he's doing now with like Blumhouse, you know, these, you know, smaller budgeted, you know, compared to his bigger budgeted movies, like, you know, smaller films that have, you know, interesting things to say. I like when he does that. Like, I think that is that is when he's at his best, you know. Because I love The Visit, you know. I love Split, and Glass may be, you know, bigger budgeted, but it still feels like more grounded than anything. And I like when he works that way. So to me, yeah, it has that feeling. It has him, you know, feet on the ground. You know, he is a master of like creating suspenseful imagery, you know, suspenseful scenes. So I like this mode of Shyamalan, so I guess that's my point. That's me in The Happening. I appreciate it now more than I've ever appreciated it.
Great, and that's a great place to end. So, Marcella, where can people find you online?
They can find me personally on Twitter at Marcella J. Pico. But hey, if you don't want to follow me, you can follow Talk Film Society at Talk Film SOC and go to the website, talkfilmsociety.com. If you're listening to this podcast, you may know who we are. Listen to our other podcasts, read our articles. We do good stuff. I think we do, and that's probably me being biased, but whatever.
No, we definitely do great stuff. And I also may be biased, but whatever. You can find me on Twitter at TheManish89. That's TheManish89. Also, yeah, TalkFilmSociety.com, where you can catch my writing there. Tune in next week. We're going to be talking about the aforementioned The Last Airbender, which is going to be interesting. I have never seen it.
Oh my gosh.
Stay tuned for that, and thanks for listening. Bye.